Exactly on time. We are moving now into a talk by Frank Krause from Durham, and his talk is on June, open source individual-based epidemiology simulation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. I hope you can hear me and see the slides.
I can.
Fantastic. Let me start by saying that I'm a particle physicist by training. So a lot of the things that we discussed before, like open sourcing your code or how you deal with data, in a way is second nature to us as a field. So that's why I think we from the beginning we thought that our code should be open source, and indeed it is. Let me briefly talk about what is in June. And I would like to start by saying that we start this completely by accident. I wanted to show my kids what a pandemic is, and out of a sudden, a couple of our PhD students got interested, and so we build a code. Our code, roughly speaking, has four layers. There's a population layer, an interaction layer, a layer where we model the disease transmission and what happens once you're infected, and a policy layer that interacts with the interaction layer and changes the behavior of people. So let me start with the population layer very, very briefly. Our input was the last census data. And as you may know, the last census from 2011 and the ongoing from 21, they have hierarchical structures, and we break it down to the level of output errors, which is of the order of 250 residents. And at that level, we have information about age, sex, ethnicity, deprivation index, etc. And if you take for an example, Durham, you see this big green area with a very young population. This is where our colleges are. And then in center of town, there's an area with a very male population. And in the beginning, we were quite shocked by it, but then we realized that this is Durham Prison. So we resolve a lot of the granularity in the population. But more than just the people, we also have information about how the households are made up in about 20 categories. And they also include communal facilities, like, for instance, care homes. Now, in order to have realistic households, we have to distribute our people on the households, and for that we need secondary information, like, for instance, the age difference between partners or between parents and children. And you may start guessing now that we actually simulate every individual in England and Wales. So we put 55 or so million virtual people into a computer, we put them into households with the geographical information of the output areas. We then use geolocations of nearest appropriate schools. We put students into the schools. We organize them in fixed classes, and we distribute teachers. At the MSOE level, which is about 10 to 15,000 people, we distribute workers and the companies in of the order of 20 macro sectors with some standard industrial classification scheme. And we use the known age and sex distribution to distribute the workers in a meaningful way. And finally, we look at commuters, and we kind of distribute between interregional travel, regional commutes, and inner metropolitan travel. And we organize people in carriages and buses of say 50 to 100 people. And so this is our population layer. And We started coding stuff up end of March last year, and I think this was roughly the level we had in May last year. So we were relatively quick, which happened basically because our students are quite good at coding. So then we moved to the daily structure of our virtual population, because our people now have to do stuff, right? They have to go out, they have to go to work, they have to go to school, they have to go shopping. And for that, we used a combination of surveys from the Office of National Statistics and some sector-specific statistics to figure things out. And we use all this to translate the numbers of hours spent in different locations into a probabilistic measure of how people organize themselves. And what you see here as a plot is a comparison of what our code says in blue compared to what the ONS is in light green and the dark green is the overlap between the two. And you see, we kind of overestimate how hard people work or go to school, and we underestimate other activities. This is a little bit of an oldish plot. In the meantime, we added a few more activities, like, for instance, going to a gym. So we now know where our people live, where they go to work. We know where they go shopping because we have the geolocations of all these facilities. And now we have to figure out how they mix, how often they have some meaningful contacts. And for that, we wanted to use the Polymod and BBC Pandemics project data. But the tricky thing is, when you look at the social mixing matrices, they're pretty much done for SIR models. So they are implicit averages over the full population. And that means you have to renormalize stuff to account for the number of participants in a specific environment. As an example, if you look at schools, you see the average number of contacts children or students have with adults. But clearly the main context with adults is not with just any adult in the population, but with the teachers in the population. So you have to account for the fact that out of the 40 million or so adults in the English and Welsh population, only 400,000 or so are teachers. And that is something you have to factor in. And so we get the social mixing matrices that look pretty similar to Polymod and BBC out of it. And it gives also a nice closure test of that we get our social environments not completely wrong. Now, for disease transmission, we took what you pretty much find in the literature. So we have a probability that depends on the amount of time people spend together in the same environment. We have the individual susceptibilities. We have some closeness in environment, which we modulate by the contact matrices, and we have an infectiousness profile. And you see that for different levels of illness between severe and asymptomatic, the infectivity changes. With that, now we can move toward the outcomes of the infection. And you see there's different journeys. You can be asymptomatic and you would recover, or you can develop symptoms of increasing severity and you will either recover or die of it. Now, in order to get things right, especially for the first wave, the care home residents were pretty hard hit. So we distinguished between the general population and care home residents to figure out what happened to people and what their maximum level of severity was, between asymptomatic to over severe illness to being in a regular ward, being in an intensive care unit, or in terms of dying. And we used data from a wide range of sources, from Office of National Statistics, Public Health England, NHS, etc. Let me just say, this was probably the most disheartening data mining exercise I've ever seen. The data are massively inconsistent. They have huge holes and points. So there's a non-trivial level of inference in it. I think this was one of the places where we spent a lot of time with a clear sense of futility in it. Anyway, this is what came out, and we validated our outcomes with other models like Imperial or the Ward model. And finally, that brings me to the policy layer. And I don't want to start slacking off the government, but the constant changes of policy is a challenge in itself, and you have to figure out how you deal with it and how you validate stuff. And just as an example, you see how we validate our school attendance between what June thinks or what we put into the code and what the Department for Education says. And the plateau at the beginning of the first wave is interesting because it tells you that we got an assessment of core workers not completely wrong. The other plot is a validation of restaurant and pub visits with data from OpenTable, and you see the beautiful effect of the eat out to help out scheme, with beautiful spikes where restaurants are twice as occupied as at normal times. Okay, so that brings me to some results for the first wave. So we looked into a couple of different markers, like hospital admissions, total deaths, deaths in hospitals. The results are relatively old. These are results of about 9 months ago. In the meantime, a lot of our PhD students had to write up their thesis, so our work got a little bit interrupted, and we just restarted about 2 months ago. So anyway, this is an example for deaths in hospitals in the first wave, and the all of England is the bottom right, and the other one top row, and the first three of the bottom row are the seven different regions in England. And you see we get it reasonably okay. In the meantime, we refitted and we improved it a little bit. We also looked at the age distribution, and that doesn't look completely unreasonable. And that is hospital deaths in England by age in age bins as provided by the NHS. We also looked at where people actually die. And that is quite important for us because we want to make sure that we get the differentiation between the general population and the care homes correct. And it seems we actually got it pretty okay. And yeah, this is a plot that we made mid-August last year, where we had fitted, and you see the total deaths in England, our code versus data, blue versus black, where blue is our code and orange was our prediction in end of September last year, end of August last year. And you see we kind of got that not completely wrong. So the one thing I want to add, just because you know our code can do it, we looked at some social imbalances, and for the data, we looked at cumulative infection rates that we got from antibodies in the blood of blood donors. Now, I want to stress that when you look at these imbalances, the only thing we put into the code are regional and sociological differences that are encoded in the census data. So the first thing you see is an age profile of infections in different age bins, typically of the size of about 10 years. But the thing that is probably more interesting is the impact of household size. And not very surprisingly, you see that the larger the household you live in, the higher your chance to be infected. But you also see the impact of ethnicity. And data suggests that in the first wave, if you were a black person, your chance of being infected was about three times as high as a white person. We kind of get this right, just based on the census information at output area level. So I think, yeah, that is, it's kind of shocking, isn't it? So we are now in a refitting procedure. So we do campaigns of about 250 runs over Latin hypercube in parameter space. And we typically eat one day for a run that covers 1 year of the full English Welsh population on a node with about 32 cores. And we have a memory footprint of the order of 70 to 100 gigabyte. So it's a little bit of an HPC project. We use Bayesian emulators to parameterize the code results at some given times. And then we deselect runs and parameter regions with some implausibility measure, which is a chi-squared-like measure. So just to give you an idea how that works, so you see some first campaigns. You see the data in black with some kind of uncertainty band that we put around it, which is a combination of some statistical error that we pretty much capture by looking at the wiggles, and then some systematic uncertainty that we add pretty much by hand because we learned the hard way that the data cannot always be uniformly trusted. So you see a first couple of campaigns, and then we refined it with the first wave, and you see we get stuff a little bit better, and that's the orange, and then we continue refining it, and we push a little bit deeper into time, and then we push deeper, and you see how our runs cover the zone of interest better and better. And so this is where we are at the moment. For the parameter space, and that is the parameter space for social distancing measures in summer, you see how over two different campaigns, we start deselecting parameter regions. And you see here the correlation between pairs of these parameters. And you see how that goes down. And it automatically generates an improvement of our description of the first wave and so that brings me to conclusions and outlook. I think it's fair to say we constructed this model pretty much within half a year or so. It has, to the best of my understanding, supreme granularity in terms of demography, geography, sociology. Our model informed the operational planning of the NHS. We did some kind of early warnings, etc. The code is highly flexible, so the addition of new effects and policies is relatively painless. And the code has also been adapted to new environments. And three of our students are in collaboration with the WHO and the United Nations to look at COVID transmission in the large refugee camps. And as an example, I named here Cox's Bazar, which is the largest refugee camp in the world with about 800,000 or so Rohingyas in Bangladesh. And I think the one thing I learned as a complete outsider to both computational sociology and epidemiology, there seems to be widespread perception in computational sociology that if you look too closely and if you put too many details into it, you stop seeing the forest for the trees. And I think that is not completely correct. And let me just say, I think epidemiology and quantum mechanics are roughly the same age device in about 100 years ago. And I think the fields have developed in a very different way. And my suspicion is it has partially to do with such a perception of how detailed you have to look. So as an outlook, let me just say at the moment we code frantically the impact of vaccination protocols and the impact of additional strains and how the reinfection probability affects the susceptibility. We have to look in what happened during Christmas. So for to kind of see what lockdown measures do, we typically use Google mobility data. And we have to check what it tells us about the five wild days of Christmas this year. The one thing that we want to put in is to follow up on studies of these social imbalances. And let me just show you one plot that I find quite interesting. If you take age as a proxy for your survival probability, then the change in life expectancy depending on your socioeconomic index suggests that people of the same age in different socioeconomic environments have a different physiological age and therefore different survival probability. And finally, let me just show you the names of my teammates. So it's 8 PhD students from particle physics and astrophysics from the SDFC funded doctoral training center in Durham, and a couple of other people with a background in astronomy, computer science. We have the clinical lead of the COVID coordination of NHS England as a team member, and we have a statistician as part of our team. And with that, I would like to finish. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was fascinating. So are there any questions? I don't see any in the Q&A yet, but get typing. So one of your layers, you validated against other models. How do you know that those models themselves are valid?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know. I think it was more plausibility check that our data mining plus inference was not completely off the mark. Mm-hmm. Okay. Simply put, I think the status of the data that are publicly available is really detrimental to the modeling efforts. And so you have to, at some point, you have to operate with assumptions, and you try to validate this assumption. You try to validate this assumption with other statistics and so, but at the end of the day, you have to convince yourself that after all this data mining and inference and honestly, maybe even biases, you come up with, say, fatality rates that are in agreement with anybody. It's just, just to confirm that although you may have different biases, they lead to halfway consistent results, which I think is the best thing we can do at the moment.
Excellent. No, that's really important, isn't it? So just a quick question for the organisers. Somebody's asking, they've got problems typing in the Q&A. I discovered I couldn't myself type in the Q&A. I guess that's because I'm a panellist. So if you could just check those settings are great, that would be lovely. So now we are moving exactly to time. Thank you everyone for your promptness into the Q&A session.